from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. It's The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Mike Pesca, host of the podcast The Gist, tells us how comics are reacting to the firing of Shane Gillis by Saturday Night Live. And from the minds behind BoJack Horseman, the new animated series Undone will make you question your own sense of reality.
Two people could be watching the episode together, and at the end of the episode go, wow, so I guess that really explained it, huh? She's lost it. No, what are you talking about? That explained it. She has magic powers. And they could see the same episode two different ways.
And a new play about what mariachi music means to Mexican-American families. All that coming up on The Frame. This week, Saturday Night Live said it would not be welcoming a new cast member by the name of Shane Gillis. Almost as soon as SNL initially hired the comedian, recordings of racist and homophobic comments Gillis had recently made started circulating. Mike Pesca is host of Slate's daily podcast, The Gist. This week is the show's comedy week, and Mike asked some comedians about Gillis's firing. And I asked Pesca if Gillis's past offensive material was that hard to find.
Well, I put the name Shane Gillis in the search function of the app I use for listening to podcasts, and he's all over them. He has his own podcast. He goes on podcasts associated with a group of, they would consider it, extremely non-politically correct guys known as the Legion of Skanks. He's affiliated. He's affiliated with the Skanks. And it's out there. It's very readily listenable and available. And he does comedy, or sometimes not even comedy, you know, talks among his friends in what he hopes to be a humorous context where they don't pause for a second about using words that would be considered ethnic slurs, and especially with Shane using a lot of stereotypical Asian accents. I mean, that just didn't happen once or twice. That was a mainstay of the things that he talks about on numerous podcasts.
Yeah, let's listen to a bit of what he had to say on his podcast.
It's funny, too, because that's more annoying than any other minority playing music at a restaurant, loud on their phone.
Do you think
an Asian trying to learn English bothers me more than someone listening to, like, Lil Uzi Vert while I'm trying to eat dinner?
That's hilarious.
Yeah, nice racism.
That's nice good racism. That's good racism.
Yeah, he goes on to say other bad things. You recently put together a roundtable as part of your live show for The Gist, Comedy Week, and you had some comedians talking about his hiring and his firing, and it felt like there were some differences of opinion. How would you categorize how they thought about the way that his hiring and firing was handled?
Yeah, I framed the discussion as an obvious tension because they are comics. They believe in free expression. Also, the history of comedy in America and going on right now around the world is if offense is given, to try to clamp down that offense, to silence the comic. Not a good thing. None of my guests, no real comedian would say that's a good thing. On the other hand, it is true that you could do or say anything and say, oh, it's just a joke as a justification. And we often hear that from the highest reaches these days of American power. So of the three comedians, Hari Kondabolu is, to me, one of the more fascinating people in comedy because he was a former community organizer. He has a degree from the London School of Economics. He has a background in, I guess you could call it, activism. And he even produced a documentary about the use of the character Apu on The Simpsons, essentially asking The Simpsons to either have an Indian American actor do the accent, do the character of Apu, or to discontinue Apu, sort of raising issues about what Apu, how Apu made him as an Indian American South Asian feel. Given this background, perhaps not surprisingly, he thought that Shane had transgressed and doesn't deserve a spot on Saturday Night Live. There's no such thing as deserving a spot on SNL, and was absolutely fine with letting him go. On the other hand, one of my other comedians who I talked to, Marina Franklin, knows Shane, says she likes Shane, and really did have mixed feelings about it because people can say things that are bad, and yet she said, I know, I don't think I've ever been racist, but maybe someone else would think that, and maybe I've given offense. And so she very much was given pause by the idea of going and silencing comedians.
We're talking with Mike Pesca about the comedian Shane Gillis. I want to ask you what the reaction was to what Shane said when Saturday Night Live revoked his invitation to join the cast. And he said, I'm quoting him now from his Twitter feed, I'm happy to apologize to anyone who's actually offended by anything I've said, unquote. Not sure how to parse that apology, but it feels like it sparked a lot of different kinds of reactions.
How it often plays out is someone does something wrong, they try to fight it a little bit, and then they give an apology, and the apology is jumped on as inadequate. In fact, in the history of apologizing for these transgressions, there are really three or four go-to examples of people doing it right. I could think of Seth Rogen gave a very good apology. Jonah Hill went on the Howard Stern show and talking about using a gay slur and how never do it. Most people said that's a good apology. And the comedy writer and showrunner Dan Harmon gave an apology that was so good that This American Life did a segment on it. But most of the time, people will find the apology inadequate, especially if it includes any hedging language, any traditional language, the if you were offended construct. And in this case, there seems to be the implication that Shane is saying, I will apologize to anyone who is actually offended, implying I think a lot of these people are making a big deal about nothing.
Right. And I think the lesson, of course, is if you don't want people talking about your racist jokes from the past, don't have racist jokes in your past.
You know, yes, but then what is the definition of racism? And Sarah Silverman, you know, made jokes that I suppose a transcript could indicate that they were racist. But of course, she was playing a character and making a point. I think the lesson is like, if you are going to knowingly commit to a form of comedy that has no fear or favor for the mores of our times, you can write off and not expect to be embraced by the longest running most establishment comedic institution in the United States.
Mike Pesca is the host of the Slate Daily podcast, The Gist. He also contributes reports and commentary to NPR. Mike, thanks so much for coming on The Frame.
You're welcome.
Coming up next on The Frame, the creative minds behind BoJack Horseman have a mind-boggling new series called Undone. Amazon Prime released its first original adult animated series last week. It's called Undone, and it's from the creator of BoJack Horseman, Raphael Bob Waksberg, and Kate Purdy, the writer of some standout BoJack episodes. The series blurs reality for both the main characters and the audience. The premise of Undone is kind of hard to describe, so let's hear Purdy explain it.
The show is about a young woman who is stuck in a rut and believes there has to be more to life. And then she gets into a car accident and her dead father comes to her and says, you're right, there is more to life. And I'm going to unlock these abilities in you so that you can experience time and space in a new way. And then the show explores whether this is happening to her or not. And then what is reality and what are our perceptions of reality?
Okay. Kate Purdy and Raphael Bob Waksberg explain to me why they chose what's called rotoscope animation for the look of Undone.
Well, when we were writing the scripts, we didn't actually know what the medium would be. We considered live action, but we wanted to do animation because in animation, you can play with the flexibility of reality and you can invite your viewer to imagine more easily.
Yeah, in a way that doesn't feel like, oh, here come the special effects now. You know, we wanted the show to feel both very grounded and very fantastical at the same time, without a lot of membrane between those two worlds. We didn't want to feel like, oh, here's the real world, and then snap your fingers, and suddenly we're in magic world. We wanted the magic to kind of live side by side with the real, so you kind of wouldn't quite know at any given moment where you're standing. And rotoscope animation kind of gives you that flexibility and kind of gives you the best of both worlds, in that it can feel very grounded and real and sometimes unsettlingly so and very intimate. And it really feels like you're with these characters because it picks up on these tiny little micro expressions in their faces. And our actors are so good and so expressive and you feel like you're inside them almost. But then also it allows the walls of whatever building we're in to fall apart and a character to shoot into outer space.
I want to play a clip from the first episode of Undone. It's Alma, who's played by Rosa Salazar, and she's having a blowout with her sister, who's played by Angelique Cabral.
You don't want to marry Reed?
Oh, right. I get it. He's white and he's rich,
That's
so you don't like
point.
Him. Well, what is the point?
Because we're broken people. Okay? And broken people break people.
No, I'm not broken, Alma. I'm not.
I mean, that is such a big idea in this series. The whole idea of being broken and about mental health and how you see yourself and whether or not what you see is real. That feels so important to this series. And I want to ask you about why that became such the focus of what you're trying to do with Undone.
For me, it comes from a personal place. My grandmother, Geraldine, was schizophrenic, and I didn't know her. She died before I was born. And so I always worried about my mental health, knowing that it runs in the family. And then in my mid-30s did have a breakdown, had depression and anxiety, and then had to find my way out of that. I sought out all kinds of ways to help myself, including traditional allopathic or Western medicine and psychiatry. And some of that was very helpful. But what was ultimately the most helpful to me was Ayurveda and alternative healing from these shamanistic cultures and indigenous cultures. And I think talking with these shamans, and there was a new perception of what reality was. In fact, the people who hear voices or have visions are often the wise ones, or the ones who are seers or who have knowledge. And that shift my frame of reference in terms of thinking about, well, what this could be that I'm experiencing, and open myself up to a larger possibility of what reality is. So just in that reframing, and then also sort of ceremony and meditation and other practices helped me realign my life.
I want to play a clip from the third episode. This is where Alma's father, who is played by Bob Odenkirk, is giving a lecture.
So let's talk about time travel. Theoretically, why is time travel impossible? Come on, guys. We talked about this last week. What is the barrier?
The light speed barrier?
The light speed barrier. Thank you, Farnaz. So does anything move faster than light?
No.
Superman?
Quantum entanglement does.
Quantum entanglement does. Very good. Now, how does this help us with time travel? Anybody? Come on. No one knows? Well, that's a shame.
When I can't find my wallet, I blame quantum entanglement. But this is where the series starts to get really interesting, because what you're doing with time, just in terms of the way the stories unfold, it's almost like a Chris Nolan movie, like Interstellar, where it's like, wait, is that thing affecting the other thing? What does the wall look like in your writer's room? Because I'd love to see what the chronology of these characters' lives looks like to you.
It looks like a conspiracy board, like strings and clippings and
charts and postcards and
all sorts of different color-coded index cards.
And there's a lot of like, wait, what? Wait, wait, what's happening?
So this relates to that episode, and this is going to come back in this episode. And there's, okay, no, we changed what happens in episode 5, so I have to go back to episode 2 and change the scene in episode 2.
It feels like an 8,000-piece puzzle. And you take one puzzle piece away, and the whole thing falls apart. And then you have to create a new puzzle.
And, you know, one thing we pushed against a little bit was this idea that we need to explain everything, or we have to start to notice patterns and how these abilities work, or how these visions manifest themselves. And I think we wanted it to feel more emotional or intuitive and loose and surprising and lost a little bit of what is happening and how is this happening, and never quite getting a handle on it or explaining it.
We're talking with Raphael Bob Waksberg and Kate Purdy about their new series, Undone. So I want to play a clip of Alma in the first episode.
I'm so bored of living. I wake up every morning in the same bed with the same person. I shower, brush my teeth, I get dressed, and I eat the same breakfast and then take the same commute to work. I'm 28 years old and I'm terrified. This is all there is.
I think that's something that a lot of people don't really understand about mental illness or about dark thoughts, is that you look at somebody that's like, well, you've got a job, you've got family. Why do you not see things as they can be, as opposed to how they, you know, might be worse?
And that feels so integral to the story about understanding how somebody sees the world that way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think in constructing Alma as a main character, we wanted to show how she's marginalized. She's sort of outside in a lot of different ways. She's pulled between worlds. So her mother is Mexican-American, and her father is Jewish-American. And so she has these different lineages. She's also hearing, but she has part of her life where she was deaf and now has a cochlear implant. So she's in between those two worlds as well. And she's also between the worlds of reality. Is this real or not? Is this happening to me or not? So seeing her stretch in those different ways is a way of demonstrating how she's sort of out of time and space within reality and finding her identity and finding her place.
The other thing that seems key is that you don't want to tell the audience exactly what is and is not real, that you are going to be ambiguous just as Alma is unsure about what's happening to her. You're not going to point people to say, well, don't believe that or do believe this. Why was that important to you in terms of making sure that you're not signifying things too clearly?
Well, part of what the show is playing with is perceptions of reality and this idea that we all come into every situation with our own perceptions based on our life experiences. So every character in the show actually has a clear sense of what they believe is right or wrong or happening or not happening, and those are often challenged. And so we want the audience to come to this and have their own interpretation of what is happening based on who they are and what their experience is. So they're part of the show. They're interacting with it just based on how they're perceiving it and how they're interpreting it. So it's kind of grander idea of perhaps none of us holds the absolute truth. And if we can sort of see outside of ourselves and realize maybe the truth is larger than any one of us, maybe it's interaction of all of our truths, then that's a nice thing to realize.
And I think even every writer and every actor and every animator on the show might have a different opinion of what is happening on the show. I feel like in conversations in the writer's room or on set, there'll be, well, what are we saying in this moment? Are we saying this or are we saying the other thing? And we try to be careful that every episode can be interpreted through multiple lenses and that, you know, two people could be watching the episode together and at the end of the episode go, wow. So I guess that really explained it, huh? She's lost it. No, what are you talking about? That explained it. She has magic powers. And they could see the same episode two different ways.
You two met on BoJack, I believe.
Yes.
And I initially thought that Undone and BoJack don't have a lot in common. And I was talking with my producer, Julia Paskin, and she's like, they do.
And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that, of course, she was right.
How would you define where they line up most obviously and maybe most subtly?
Well, the talking animals.
Okay.
We have no talking animals on Undone. Some of the similarities are maybe the sensitivity and the melancholy, the prickliness of the protagonist, substance abuse, certainly, mental health issues, using comedy as a deflection.
Well, in both shows, we end up looking at kind of lineage, mm-hmm. you know, how you're shaped by your parents.
Yes, inherited trauma.
Inherited trauma. Yeah, I would agree. I think the sort of darker, more somber, more sullen episodes of BoJack
represent some of the lighter episodes of Undone.
Raphael Bob Blocksberg and Kate Purdy are the creators and writers of Undone. It's on Amazon. Raphael and Kate, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
What a treat for all of us.
Up next on The Frame, going through life with the soundtrack of mariachi music. If you're going to make a playlist about life in Southern California, mariachi music would definitely make the cut. For many Mexican Americans, that classic blend of violins, guitars, and trumpets with songs belted out in Spanish is a soundtrack to family life. A new play that just opened at South Coast Rep reveals why. It's called American Mariachi, and Frame contributor Marcos Najera has our story.
I recently joined the audience for the opening night of American Mariachi. More on that in a moment, but first, I want to tell you how that day started. In Whittier that morning, law professor Luz Herrera was sitting in the front row of a church. She was holding hands with her mom, Esperanza. They gently wiped away tears during the funeral mass for Luz's dad, 80-year-old Juan José Herrera Camacho. And all the while, from inside the church to the outside courtyard to the beautiful rolling green hills of his graveside, the musicians from Mariachi Tierra Azteca were there. Now, years ago, Juan Herrera came to the U.S. from Jalisco. That Mexican state is generally considered the birthplace of mariachi, so it's fitting that Señor Herrera loved this music. Throughout his life, he sang it, he played it. So on this, his last day, his daughter Luz made sure it was sung and played for Juan. Una cruz de madera
de la más corriente. It was a no-brainer. It was my dad's service, so I had to have mariachis. Couldn't have it any other way. Lo único que quiero es que canten canciones que es una gran fiesta, la muerte de un pobre. For me, the church part was hard because he was always there with me. We would always sing. He loved to sing. Yo no quiero penas, no quiero tristezas, yo no quiero nada. He was there because of the music. Lo único que quiero es allá en mi velorio, una serenata por la madrugada. Hope that you think it's an appropriate goodbye, Dad.
Driving from the funeral to the opening night festivities for American Mariachi, a realization came. My Mexican-American family is just like the Herreras, and the Herreras are just like the fictional theatrical family I was about to see on stage. And that's because mariachi music is the soundtrack, at least unofficially, to our lives.
She played mariachi. Can you believe that? There was a brief time in Mexico when women were allowed to play.
In American Mariachi, we meet Lucha. While her mom battles dementia, Lucha tries to find a way to help her. So she learns to play and sing her mom's favorite mariachi song. Lucha even forms an all-girl mariachi group, that despite the jeers from a chauvinist 1970s music industry.
Holy, look, about the band. I don't want to give up, but I'm out of ideas. We gotta do this.
For playwright Jose Cruz Gonzalez, dealing with dementia is a tough topic he knows all too well. His mom, Maria, was diagnosed early last year.
My mom's now in a home where they're taking care of her, and we go visit her all the time. And she's such a bright light in that room. She doesn't remember much. It's a reboot every time we see her. She thinks she's going home.
As a little boy in the 1960s, Gonzalez says the sounds of Mexican ranchera legend Javier Solís filled their Watsonville house up in Northern California. The music kept them going, despite a hardscrabble farmworker life. El que pierde a una mujer.
My mom was a widow with four little boys, and on weekends my mother would clean the house. Everybody had to clean the house. And she'd have her little tocadisco, record player, playing her mariachi music. And I remember those days. It's a memory I hope I never forget.
Gonzalez eventually became a prolific playwright and professor. And one day on the Cal State LA campus, where he's taught for many years, he popped into a music performance class taught by mariachi pioneer Cynthia Flores.
He was so bad.
Yeah.
Flores taught him to play the songs of his youth. She's now music director of Gonzalez's American Mariachi, and she even inspired him to include some of her own memories in the script, like the time she squeezed into a traditional mariachi costume while pregnant.
I didn't want to wear a huipil, which the women had done before, the ones who kept playing. But I'm a mariachi. I'm not from Yucatan. You know, I want to wear the mariachi skirt. So a seamstress and I figured out how to make one suit that could keep expanding with my belly.
I told the cast today, mariachi music, it puts it all on the line. It doesn't hold back on anything.
That is show director Christopher Acebo.
It gives you your greatest passion, your greatest love, your greatest joy, your greatest pain. It doesn't hold back on its emotional life. You know, there's you know, the lyric is, I want to die from feeling.
But for playwright Jose Cruz Gonzalez, his bigger hope is that the music of the mariachi always reminds families, first and foremost, to live.
Yo no quiero llantos, yo no quiero penas, no quiero tristezas, yo no quiero nada.
Family's able to sort of circle around the wagons and help carry the weight and to share it.
Una serenata por la madrugada.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
American Mariachi is at South Coast Rep in Costa Mesa through October 5th. And that's it for today. I'm John Horn at the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll see you back here tomorrow.